between the promise of neo-medieval artisan socialism and the always present tendency of fascism to reconstruct large-scale capitalism on a new basis. The question that Marcuse did not really ask in 1934 was why irrational motives predominated over rational interests in the active and passive mass basis of National Socialism. The project of the Freud-Marxist synthesis, which emerged at the peripheries of Marxist politics and the psychoanalytic movement, faced this as its most important question. Footnote 35. Text. The originators of this project were Wilhelm Reich and the associate of the Frankfurt Institute, Erich Fromm. But from his unpublished researches of the 1940s to the essay reproduced below in even more famous Elements of Anti-Semitism in Dialectic of Enlightenment, it was Adorno who appropriated the result of the Freud-Marx synthesis for the major tendency within critical theory. Page 18. In relationship to the genesis of the mass psychology of fascism, he was able to show how the protection of anti-capitalism in a direction not dangerous to capital, that is, the absolute commercial capitalism associated with the Jews, and the irrational identification with the state, the leader and the anonymous mass could replace and satisfy the need and desire to concrete non-mythological community. Fascism, for Adorno, releases the subjectivity of destroyed subjects in the form of paranoia, an irrational aggressive projection. The manipulation of fascist agitators, effective only vis-à-vis anomic and accidental crowds, masses, represents the technology of psychoanalysis in reverse. The last phrase is used by Adorno also in relationship to the mass culture of late capitalist cultural industries. It was his belief that the socio-psychological manipulation of fascism that is based on the utilization of the irrational is anticipated and prepared by the mass cultural reduction of the last traces of ego into id. Thus, socio-psychologically at least, Adorno was able to present fascism as a general problem of laced bourgeois society. Here lay the root of his tendency to present the world of the culture industry as completely without hope. It is in this context especially that the emergence of the Soviet form of the authoritarian state could never be assimilated to the analysis of merely one type of social formation, the authoritarian state or state capitalism. The first Frankfurt theorist to consider the transition to a fully authoritarian state in the Soviet Union was Otto Kirchheimer. In 1933, several years before his association with the Institute, Kirchheimer investigated the consequences of both the excess of utopianism and the excess of party-oriented realpolitik for the popular democratic Soviets or councils. Revising an earlier, footnote 35a, text, and more favorable assessment of Soviet politics, the essay Marxism, Dictatorship, and the Organization of the Proletariat criticized both the primitive democratic dreams of Lenin's state and revolution and the authoritarian tendencies of Bolshevik organization. The latter, in particular, according to Kirchheimer, led to an identification of party with bureaucratic state administration, destroying through the acceptance of bureaucratic forms both intra-party democracy and the earlier dynamic links to the underlying population. For a centralized and centralizing party in control of the bureaucratic state, however, the loss of contact with their mass base could only mean terror. Here was a creative, though not only implicit, application of the Marxian analysis of Jacobinism of the Soviet Union, more convincing than Trotsky's uncertain chuckling with the slogans of Thermidor and Bonapartism. The main line of critical theory represented by Horkheimer did not, as we have said, pick up on these key elements, the period of its distant administration for the Soviet Union in 1930s. Page 19. In fact, until Marcuse's much later, 1957, Soviet Marxism, no Frankfurt-type analysis of the Soviet Union was attempted. Horkheimer's authoritarian state, which we have already introduced as the theoretical watershed in the politics of critical theory, precisely in relation to the Soviet Union, was only a partial exception in this context. The essay certainly reveals the deep effect on critical theory of Soviet developments and of the parallel ossification of the working class movement in the West. But its theoretical claims about Bolshevism were rather well known, though not for that reason false. Horkheimer's analysis of the continuity between bureaucratic working class organization and integral statism only repeated arguments often drawn from Max Weber. On the other hand, the assumption of Horkheimer's imminent critique, repeated by Marcuse in 1957, that the admittedly most consistent form of authoritarian state was, because of its working-class ideology, the most open to liberating a cataclysmic social change based on a new council movement, derived from an inadequate analysis of Soviet conditions and of the nature of Soviet Marxism as pseudo-science of legitimation. Much more convincing was Frank Neumann's suspicion in 1951, rejected by Marcuse in 1957, that the failure of permanent revolution in its international context and the failure of democratic revolution internally not only led to the totalitarian politics of the five-year plans, but converted the holders of political power into a new class. Thus, a preparatory dictatorship became a permanent one. Footnote 36. Text. Unfortunately, because of a hidden orthodox Marxist bias that expects dynamic change only from global subjects, the older critical theory could never contribute much to the analysis of the limits of his permanence. Without the same sharpness of political vision as Neumann and Kirchheimer, Horkheimer was nevertheless remarkable for deducing the theoretical consequences of the political deformation of an originally Marxist movement. Contrary to all his earlier positions, he now understood that the reading of Marx's critique of political economy as a positive theory of development from market to planned economy anticipates the collapse of liberal capitalism, but of the new society only its authoritarian form. This was the political side of the famous Frankfurt redefinition of Marxism as the critique of ideology. Furthermore, to be more precise, even the negative critique of the capitalist market-orientated anarchy of production could easily imply the legitimation of the abstract negation of the authoritarian central plan. This was the political meaning of another famous Frankfurt theoretical move from the critique of political economy to the critique of instrumental reason. Page 20. Horkheimer did not argue that Marxian theory necessarily implied its own theoretical deformation any more than the working class movement necessarily led to the authoritarian state. Instead, he seemed to believe that neither in their classical form were sufficiently protected against deformation that anticipated the new system of domination, and as he saw critical theory to be the theoretical corrective. In 1940, no matter how briefly, he saw council communism as the analogous political corrective. The two found each other in that brief moment when the main theorists of the Frankfurt persuasion included the Soviet Union in their general critique without abandoning all hope in a Marxian politics. The key to the brief duration of this moment lies in the different types of conceptualization that explored the genesis of the third type of the authoritarian state, or state capitalism, the type represented by the New Deal and all later neo-capitalist social formations. The emergent structure and dynamics of neo-capitalism. The specific historical matrix for the emergence of neo-capitalism, to use a neutral term for the democratic or manipulated version of a state capitalism, was for all Frankfurt theorists the Great Depression. Pollock's already mentioned analysis of the 1930s led to some doubt about the possibility of a non-fascist solution to the problem of capitalist planning. Even so, in economic abstraction, he was able to build such a model. By 1940, in American exile, most Frankfurt theorists shifted their emphasis to this possibility. The results were by no means harmonious. Here, one can no longer speak of theoretical unity or even a merely two-sided debate concerning the possibility or impossibility of state capitalism. The arguments of Kirchheimer, a partisan of the concept of monopoly capitalism, on the changing structure of political compromise from liberalism to mass democracy were perfectly analogous to those of Adorno and Horkheimer on the degeneration of high culture in the pseudo-democratic culture industry. Footnote 37, text. This line of argument presupposed a concept of manipulated state capitalism representing a closed and increasingly totalitarian system, as in Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man. On the other hand, Pollock and Neumann, who clashed on the concept of state capitalism, seemed to agree on the possibility of a democratic version of state capitalism or monopoly capitalism that would prepare the grounds for a society based on genuinely democratic planning. Page 21. Even so, Herbert Marcuse in 1941, in Social Implications of Modern Technology, reproduced below, seemed to share the hope of Pollack and Neumann. The essay itself began just that analysis of the technological veil of science and technology as ideology, which in his later writings unmasks many totalitarian features of contemporary formal democracies that increasingly replace liberal ideology and the demand for a genuine public opinion by the imperatives of merely technical efficiency. In Marcuse's later work, the stability of state capitalist systems is all the more fateful and impenetrable people. When the technological veil rather than liberal ideology or direct domination becomes the principle of social integration. In other words, when Marcuse came to abandon all hope in democratic reform, he was to draw against all his inclinations, conclusions, implying too much structural stability for late capitalism. The same was more or less true for his 1957 analysis of the Soviet Union.